From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll meet a New York journalist looking into how Milwaukee's segregation impacts maternal mortality.
Later, why one local group has been promoting the work of art teachers for three quarters of a century.
Our interest in art, and specifically certain areas of art, drew us into teaching art. But many times over the years, that gets put aside because of the demands of teaching.
Plus, what's great about performing music in a room surrounded by old masterpiece paintings?
Knowing about each other and talking to each other and exploring the intentions, or what we presume are the intentions of the great artists, is bringing something to our own creations, our own way of approaching music.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Over the past several months, data has shown rising mortality rates among a surprising population, middle-aged, largely rural white people. But many who study public health say focusing solely on that data ignores the historical disparities in other areas, such as maternal mortality among African-American women. In Wisconsin, African-American women are five times more likely to die from complications of pregnancy.
That particular area is of interest to journalist Rita Henley Jensen. Jensen is the founder of the Jane Crow Project, which is exploring the causes for poor health outcomes among African-American women. Her research brought her from New York to Milwaukee to examine how segregation impacts the equation. She tells Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski what sparked her interest in the topic.
Well, I founded a news organization that covered women's issues. It was called Women's E-News. And we received a grant from the Kellogg Foundation to investigate the underlying causes of the high African-American maternal and infant mortality rates in the United States. And that we got that grant in 2009, and I've been at it ever since. There's no simple answers, as you guess. So now I left Women's E-News and went back to my one true love, which is reporting and writing. And it's a delight, even though it's scary.
So ultimately, you're working on a book. And what does this book focus on?
It's focused on the reality that if you ask experts why African-American women die more often, they'll give you the short answer, which is racism. And that's not specific enough. And people even have laughed at me. Well, how can that cause it, right? And so really, it's an exploration of how racism can harm the health of African-American women to the extent that they are vulnerable to dying or experiencing severe morbidity, which is harm from the labor or delivery process. How could that be? And as you know, I think every good journalism project starts with that question, how could that be? And it's taken me a while.
Right, since 09.
How could that be?
Some of the numbers on your site state that the U.S. has the highest maternal mortality rate among developed nations, and half of the deaths are preventable, and African-American women die giving birth three times more often compared to women of other races. And you are based in New York, but you're here in Milwaukee doing research as well. So what are the bad reasons that bring you here to Milwaukee?
I know. Well, I think first I ought to say it's a great fun to be here, but the data in Milwaukee, as everyone in this town knows, I think, it is the most segregated city in the United States. And segregation has an impact on maternal mortality. They don't completely understand how and why, but the pressure and all the discrimination that's connected to segregation makes them more vulnerable. In the state of Wisconsin, African-American women die 5 times more often than white women due to pregnancy-related causes. 5? That's more than Georgia. Georgia's 4. And the national average is somewhere between 3 and 4. So what is going on? And because, as most people know, most African Americans live in Milwaukee. I came here to say, and I don't know, I can't claim to know, but I'm asking the question, which is my job.
Well, and what have you heard from residents here that you've visited with? What have they shared with you in regards to their experience? And have they suggested any kinds of solutions at all, or just chronic problems that they keep on facing?
From my conversations with people here, it's an issue that's very low on the totem pole. And I went to the Milwaukee Public Health Department's website, and there's very little reflection of a concern for that. If the health department doesn't lead the concern, it's problematic. So the daily life, I met somebody who went to prison for murdering her abuser and got out and went to college and is now dedicated to helping other women. I met a woman who is fiercely protective of African-American mothers who are litigating, suing, in trouble with the Children's Services. And she feels pretty strongly, I have to say, that there's an institutional bias there. So does it matter if you're pregnant and you're afraid that you'll lose custody of your child? Probably. That's a stress. Is it an issue if you're battered? Probably. Is it an issue if you're in prison or you've been in prison? Probably. Is it an issue that you can't get cash from the welfare department to pay your rent? Really likely. So you go on and down the list of the stressors that African-American women experience more often, not solely, obviously. White women experience these types of stressors as well. But it's more likely if you're African American, and it certainly is more likely if you're living in a segregated city.
Some of those things that you mentioned kind of contribute to the racial and gender bias that affect African American women. But how does it compare to what you've studied in New York and other cities? You mentioned Georgia is, right above us with
right.
in terms of.
Right.
So what other cities have the same problem to this severity?
Well, I really can't fully answer that question, but I know that New York City, you'll be happy to learn, tops Milwaukee in that African-American women die 12 times as often in New York City. And we have public hospitals. We have generous Medicaid benefits. How does this happen? New York City is such a challenge. I thought I'd start with a smaller city and maybe figure it out.
Work up from there. Well, and on the other end of the spectrum, where in the country or even the world is this not a critical problem? What places are doing this right in that the mothers are healthy and surviving childbirth?
The rest of the world is doing mainly much more poorly than the United States. Within the United States, California, they've really focused on it. Many of the deaths and the injuries are avoidable, and they really focused on how to avoid maternal injury death in the labor room. There's this program sponsored by Merck for Mothers that focuses, as the head of the program said, if you've seen one labor room, you've seen one labor room. And what she means by that is there's no standard protocol in the United States to treat those emergencies in the labor room. But California changed that, and they now have a standard training protocol and preparedness kits, et cetera, for those emergencies. California has reduced its maternal mortality significantly, but the ratio remains different, right? It's still 1 to 4. And I've spoken to the head of the program, and he's determined to find out what in California it can explain this.
What are those avoidable factors that California addresses?
Well, again, the emergency training for the labor room and delivery room staff. And there's hemorrhage, for example, is a common killer, which is very upsetting. It's a common reason that women die. And he's trained this particular head of the program has worked with a coalition throughout the state and has trained those personnel. And it's like a football team. You know, if you work together and you've trained together, you know, when emergency happens, when someone passes you the ball, you don't know what to do. And he's had quite a bit of success. And he is determined to continue.
So really minimizing the time it takes to address a new emergency or situation as it comes.
Yes. That is the most crucial. Hemorrhaging, infection is another killer. And all hospitals in the U.S. are trying to battle infection. But the question is the fever addressed or ignored if a mom develops? And does she know that if she develops a fever, she should rush right back and get treated? That's another issue. Heart disease is an issue that's harder to deal with. Embolism, they know how to deal with that. It's really sort of hard to understand why women are still dying from embolism in childbirth.
Obviously, there can be a multitude of problems, like you just listed, that contributes
right.
to maternal mortality rates. But based on what you've explored here and kind of the information you want to find out before tackling those bigger cities, what topics are you going to dive into in the upcoming book? Are there main factors that you're checking off and kind of exploring one by one?
Well, Medicaid reimbursement rates, 69% of African-American births are paid for by Medicaid. Now, in the United States, half the births are paid for by Medicaid. Medicaid is regulated by the states, as we know, but it is a federal money that's paying for it. So the question is, how can Medicaid begin to address this problem in the states? And I think Wisconsin would be a great place to start.
Yeah.
Georgia might be another one, but we're paying the bill for this inadequate care. We, the taxpayers, are paying the bill for inadequate care that is causing mothers to die.
Too often, states and reports focus on infant mortality. Not that it's any less important, but this is one of the first times where I've seen the mother's mortality rate highlighted, and it's from your initial research, you know, your upcoming work. Why do you think that is?
Well, there's a political explanation that I'll provide. There's an entire movement here in the U.S. to stop abortion. And so the focus is on the well-being of the fetus and not the well-being of the mother. If it was focused on the well-being of mother, the law might be different. I'll just say that.
Ultimately, when you are writing your book and it comes to fruition and is printed on paper, how do you want to see your work outside of the book?
Yes.
When it's done?
Yes. Well, I've never even seen a discussion of the impact of segregated hospitals on the health of African Americans. I hope to get a list of the hospitals that are, in essence, historically Black hospitals and have the same underfunding and other issues that the historically Black colleges experience. And a lot of these hospitals are in urban areas. And therefore, there is the tax money and there's a citizen base to say, we want our mothers to get the best care possible the moment they enter the ER or the clinic or whatever, in those 2-hour-long waits in the clinic or even an 8-hour wait in the clinic are not acceptable. Let's start there. We're going to make the mothers feel welcome. I went on a local hospital's website and read the comments, and they were treated rudely. Over and that's what they claim. I wasn't there, but over and over again, there's an issue. So just start there. Let's make them feel comfortable and safe.
Well, we know there are many factors that'll be explored and delved into. So I look forward to having you back on as things progress and as the book comes.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right,
it's been wonderful.
Rita Henley Jensen is a New York-based journalist who founded and heads the Jane Crow Project. It explores the causes and impacts of Black maternal mortality. She's currently at work on a book on the subject. You can find out more at WUWM.com.
Milwaukee art teachers take a break from their students' work to focus on their own for a while. We'll learn why when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Artists often teach others to paint, sculpt, or draw. Well, they might do it because they love to, or because they need to supplement their income, or maybe a combination of both. But as anyone who teaches knows, skill, dedication, and a significant time commitment are required to do it well. And that often means artists don't have the time or energy to devote to creating their own work.
The Milwaukee Area Teachers of Art, or MATA, was formed to help artists balance their teaching and their art making. And every year they produce a curated show that showcases the diverse work of its members.
Jim Toth is MATA's president, and he joins me in the studio now. Jim, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me about MATA. Tell me about this organization, who you are, and what you do.
Well, MATA is a group of art teachers, but not exclusively art teachers. It's really anyone who supports our mission. The group formed in 1940 as the Milwaukee Art Teachers Association. But it evolved over the time to become the Milwaukee Area Teachers of Art because it really drew people from all over.
And you got to keep the same letters.
Right, yeah, and they didn't have to change the logo,
right.
Although it's gone through many transformations. But it really is people who were together to support each other, not only as art teachers, but artists. And that's really the primary function of the group.
So the idea is that if you're someone who is teaching art, you may not have as much time for your own practice.
Yes, and the group really wanted to support that aspect of being an art teacher. Our interest in art and specifically certain areas of art drew us into teaching art. But many times over the years, that gets put aside because of the demands of teaching. And the MATA group wanted to make sure that there was an outlet for exhibiting your work as well as promoting good classroom pedagogy and all that kind of thing, too.
So what kind of students do MATA teachers represent? I mean, are you working with everyone from little kids all the way to adults?
We have people in the group who teach elementary through college. We have representatives from about 30 districts in the group. So it really is far-ranging.
What about private teaching? Do you have folks who do that as well, like have their own studios and bring people in?
Some people do that. We have some, of course, in private schools as well as public schools.
So how many members do you have now?
We currently have 72 members, And like I said, they represent about 30 different districts. It's really widespread throughout the Milwaukee area, the greater Milwaukee area, for as a matter of fact.
And so what does being a member, if I were, say, an art teacher in the area and I wanted to join the organization, you know, how much time commitment is there and what kinds of things would be expected of me?
Well, there really isn't any time commitment, and there really are there aren't any high expectations as far as a membership goes. What we really would like to see our members do is connect with each other and support each other, in their art making as well as their art teaching. But, you know, if there's really, like any organization, the commitment is as much as you want to give an organization. And there's opportunity for people to become more and more involved with the group and on the board level, planning events, and especially planning the exhibitions that we give.
So I know there's one coming up. Is this the big one every year, or do you have more than one?
Well, we have more than one. This is the big one coming up, the annual membership show. It's our 76th annual membership show, which is something to think about for the longevity of that. We also have a show in the fall, a drawing, print, and photography show, and that's been held out at Carroll University for many, many years. And that's a little smaller scale show, try to focus on work that doesn't always get into the big membership show.
The big membership show is happening at the library, and it's going to be up for about a month, is that right?
Yeah, about a month, a little bit more.
Now, are the works for sale?
Yes, the work is for sale unless the artist determines it's a not-for-sale piece. And work has sold out of the show. What's great about this show in many ways is it's very eclectic. The artwork represents ceramics to weavings to paintings, abstract, representational, the whole gamut, because the interests of our group are far-ranging. And the work is usually priced such that if you are inclined, you can find a piece that you could take home.
And you're supporting a local artist which is always a good thing. It's always nice to, you know, it's one of the things I do when I travel is I always try to buy a piece of art from, and it's small, my budget's small, so I'm not buying large paintings
right,
or anything, but I try to find something that is, you know, supporting a local artist in the area.
Yeah.
And for you, mm-hmm. how many times have you participated as an artist in these exhibitions?
Well, I really didn't do the math on that, but I got involved with the group back in the, I'd say the late 70s. Early 80s when I was teaching, and actually learned the form of art that I like to practice at a Mata workshop, and I sculpt cement.
Cool.
It's kind of an interesting process, and I learned it through a Mata workshop and then took it from there and really developed it into a pretty sophisticated form of non-representational abstract sculpture.
So I have to ask, do you work with it where it's already been formed in a block, or do you work with it more wet and then apply it, or both?
Yes.
Okay.
No, I do what's called a soft carve. So I'll mix my material, I'll mix my body, I'll mix color into it so it's a marbled body, cast a block, watch it during the set, and when it's set to a certain point, I can take the forms off and start carving it. And so then I'll carve the block. And the first session is about a 6-7 hour nonstop session because I'm working against time while it's setting. And at the end of that session, I'll know if I have a piece worth continuing all the way through with or if it was a good learning experience.
And then you start again
if it was
the latter, yeah. So is the kind of cement, the kind of materials that you're using to make the cement, is it the kind of thing that you could also make, say, a counter out of or something, or is it something different?
Yeah, it's very similar to that. It's not concrete. Concrete is sand, gravel, and cement. And what I'm working with is primarily the cement body, the bonding agent. So it's very fine-grained and very hard. It's also very brittle when it's fully cured. But it's, it's a faux stone is mm-hmm. what it comes out to be. And I can take the finish down to like a bowling ball finish on it.
Wow.
It's very refined.
Now, once you're finished carving that and, you know, it's ready, do you have to do something? Do you have to fire it or is it done?
No, it's done. But the initial carving gets me to my main forms, but then there's a lot of refinement and sanding, and it's like a big jewelry piece, taking it down through the grades of sanding all the way down to 800 wet sanding.
Wow, very, very fine.
And then paste wax after it's cured.
So I assume you have a piece or two in this show?
I will have a couple pieces in this show that I made specifically for the show. And then getting back to the show in that way, that's kind of what the show has done for a lot of our members, is over the years it's given a deadline, given a focus on having a reason to continue making your art. It's easy to have year after year go by where there just isn't an outlet, and well, why bother? I'm just focused on the classroom. But having a show that's coming up that you are committed to putting work into really gets the juices going.
It's sort of like the what were they with the early impressionists in Paris? They'd have the salons where it was like that big group shows, you know, where people had to produce.
That's true. And we also, we do jury this show. And being a membership show, we guarantee that you'll get one piece in. But people can enter three pieces, members can enter three pieces, and the jurors will, you know, pick a show that they feel best represents the group. And so there's a little bit of a competition in that. But the big competition comes in that we have quite a few awards. Over the years, we've garnered a number of memorial awards honoring past members. Their families have given us some nice awards for them. We also have excellence awards that the group sponsors, life members of the group, people who have been honored with that distinction, contribute extra to fund a couple life member awards. And then we also have an emerging artist award, Frank Juarez Gallery. He's a former MATA president. Is sponsoring an emerging artist award to focus on one of our newer members.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and Frank's a great guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like his work a lot as well. Who are the jurors?
Well, the jurors this year are Josie Osborne and Liz Rex of the UWM Peck School of the Arts. And I think they've picked a very nice show. It's going to be a big one.
Okay. And so it's open when the library is open?
Yes. It's just open during library hours. And the downtown branch has pretty generous hours, so it's easy to find a time to come down and take a look.
All right. Well, best of luck. 76 years?
Yeah. 76th annual.
Yeah. So let's hope it's a great one, and we'll look forward to many more.
Thank you.
Jim Toth is president of the Milwaukee Area Teachers of Art, or MATA. The organization's annual show opens at the main branch of the Milwaukee Public Library tomorrow. It's on view through May 19th, and you can find out more information at WUWM.com.
Visual art is the theme of this month's On That Note with cellist Robert Cohen as well. We'll learn how and why when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Each month, cellist Robert Cohen joins us for a segment we call On That Note. It is an inside look into the life of a professional classical musician.
This month, Robert had the opportunity to perform in a very special room in Milan, Italy. And that experience has him thinking about how the arts inform each other. He joins us via Skype now. Hi, Robert. It's great to hear your voice.
Great to hear you too, Bonnie.
And I understand you have been in the States this last week or so doing concerts everywhere but Milwaukee.
Well, I wouldn't say everywhere, but it's been dashing about. And also, I dashed over and then back to Europe for a very quick concert, actually, which was incredibly inspiring because it was at the Brera Gallery in Milan. And it was the opening of Lorenzo Lotto exhibition. He was an Italian painter from around the 1500s. And I was doing a solo recital there in a new series, which connects music and art in a really unusual way. I mean, I've played in galleries and I've played in exhibitions where they've tried to make a link sort of between the period, you know, like an exhibition of paintings from the 20th century as though you're playing 20th century music or something like that. But this is a series which links the kind of mentality of what was going on in the heads of painters and sculptors to the mentality of the composers that were chosen for the music. And that means that you're not restricted to, like, Lorenzo Lotto was 1500, as I said. I played Bach, which was, you know, 230 years later. But the mentality, the kind of analysis of structure and the sense of psychological analysis of themselves, Bach and Lorenzo Lotto, were the things that were drawn, the connections drawn in that way. And it was somehow very fascinating and very inspiring to make that connection. And I'm sure this series is going to continue in that vein. I mean, it's an incredibly huge gallery, something like the National Gallery in Washington, for instance. But it was very specific about this one painter and a small selection of paintings.
Now, when you were first approached to do this solo recital, did you work with the curators of the exhibition to talk about those connections, to talk about that mentality that Bach and Lotto shared?
Well, we did, actually, yes. But, I mean, I have to say that the person who was involved in the as it were, the music side of it is so experienced and so interesting. And, I mean, his ideas were already quite well formed. And so when we started talking about Bach, it was more a question of, you know, is there something else that we might add to that? Whether should we stick with the kind of pure form? And in fact, that's what I did in the end. I played Bach suites. And then I just added a small piece by Pablo Casals, or that Pablo Casals was famous for, which is Song of the Birds, which is a very haunting melody, a soulful, introspective piece, which somehow just also seemed to complement the sense of freedom in the music, but also the introspection that obviously both composers had in very intensively in those paintings and in those Bach cello suites.
Is thinking about music in this way something that you do a lot when you get to your level? I mean, usually when younger musicians are practicing, you're just worrying about the music. You're worrying about the notes. You're worrying about how to express yourself well, you know, to acquit the composer's intent as well as you can. But, you know, you're at the level when you're thinking, at least certainly in this concert, you're thinking about things much bigger than just the music. And I don't mean just the music in a dismissive way, but it's like there's a whole thought process. There's a whole milieu that you're trying to comment on through the music. And is that something that you find yourself doing more and more?
Well, I do. I think it is very, you know, I do find I'm doing that more and more. And I think part of the reason is because, you know, I'm constantly exploring the possibilities, my own expression and my own sense of, in this case, what Bach wants. And so there is this constant search. And the more you discover of your own sense of emotions in the music and also your analysis of what that kind of mentality in the composer would bring out, the more fascinating it is and the more inspiring it is. I mean, I've played, you know, Bach suites all my life, but this constant search for more interesting and more fascinating ideas and the depths of the music is definitely inspired by thinking about these kind of connections between ideas and mentalities. And also just in a way, just in the case of playing in a gallery like this, you know, I walked off the stage between Bach suites and I was in a room with Picassos and all sorts of extraordinary paintings. And you're standing right next to great works of art, of history. Picasso wanted you to be standing there and to be absorbing extraordinary feelings and his outpouring of emotions and his whole sense of the world. And, you know, you're standing there just before you embark on your delving into another world, the world of music, but you feel the connection so powerfully. Even just playing in front of the paintings, which, you know, surrounded by the paintings of the great masters, something emanates from the paintings, the energy of those masters, and inspires you to be more in depth with your interpretation and your exploration of the music. And I think that, yes, probably the fact that, you know, I'm no longer at that stage when I'm worrying all the time about whether I'm going to play well and whether the notes are going to be right and whether I'm going to be able to express myself allows me, as you said, to explore much deeper areas. And I think that happens with age in a way. And interestingly enough, I met up with an amazing, in Milwaukee actually, an amazing photographer and filmmaker called Mark DePaola, who has worked in the advertising industry and as a fine art photographer and as a filmmaker. And we had long, long discussions about the parallels of the moment of taking a photograph and the way the subject is and the life and the movement in the subjects and any pictures he was taking and the movement which he was trying to capture, and very similarly to the movement in music. And it was, again, very inspiring to speak to somebody who is, you know, of a similar age to me, maybe in that point in his life where he doesn't have to worry about how he takes pictures or how the results. It's just about capturing a real profound sense of energy and movement and passion and all sorts of things. So it was fascinating to talk to him. And by chance, of course, he's in the visual arts. And I felt that was the modern version, in a sense, of the Lorenzo Lotto that I was exposed to in Milan. You know, a different form of art that is living and is an inspiration. And Mark DePaola is very inspired by music and by watching musicians and also by art. And I think that we're all so connected in these ways. And I think that knowing about each other and talking to each other and exploring the intentions or what we presume are the intentions of the great artists like Lorenzo Lotto itself is bringing something to our own creations, our own way of approaching music. And I must say, it is just a wonderful experience to talk to somebody like that, and also to, you know, to go to these galleries. I mean, perhaps I just don't do it often enough. You know, it's one of those things. I'm too busy practicing, too busy giving concerts, and forgetting that, you know, other forms of art at the greatest level are always inspiring, even if they're a different form of art.
And how wonderful when you can actually have some sort of creative dialogue with those other forms, even if it's not a direct one. You know, obviously Lorenzo Lotto is long dead and his paintings exist, but he's not there for you to have a conversation with, but you are still having a conversation with him.
Indeed, exactly. And I think that during the concert, obviously, people were probably gazing around to some degree at some of the paintings. But after the concert, we all went, you know, very specifically to look close at the paintings. And the discussions then about what everybody felt from those works of art, and somehow also the music and the music in that setting and the connections, and just talking to the public closely about what are very intimate things. I mean, these outpourings from the great masters of Bach and Lotto and so on are somehow so personal and so very intimate. You can stand, as everybody knows, you can stand in front of a great work of art and be really just, you know, in communion with them alone. You're away from the world. You're completely absorbed just in that moment, just as you are if you listen to Bach. It, you know, you are taken, you're transported, aren't you?
Well, you hope to be. And I think if you allow yourself to be, you are.
Yes. And I think we all need that, don't we?
I think we do.
In this day and age, we need to be lifted way beyond the tittle-tattle and whatever else you would like to call it that is going on around us at the moment. I mean, we definitely need to treasure that and also treasure the links between us that draw us together in such powerful ways. And that music is definitely one of those.
Well, I always treasure, speaking of treasure, I treasure our conversations every month, Robert, and I always look forward to them. And when are you next in Milwaukee?
That's a very good question. I think I'm in Milwaukee towards the end of this month, April. So quite
soon.
Soon. Yes.
Well, hopefully we will get to see each other and have a cup of tea and catch up in person. But until then, thank you so much for taking a few moments this morning.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Lovely to talk to you, Bonnie.
Robert Cohen is an internationally renowned cellist based in London. He is also a member of the Milwaukee-based Fine Arts Quartet. The quartet performs in Milwaukee at the end of the month. There's a link to more information about that show at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then an interview with poet Jody Hollander. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Poet Jody Hollander's aim is to make words sing, no matter where in the world she's writing them.
Hollander was born and raised in Milwaukee, but for the past two decades, she's been traveling the world developing her craft. She attended Pomona College in California and then went to the United Kingdom for graduate studies. Since 2007, she's been participating in artist residencies and fellowships around the world, including a Fulbright Fellowship in South Africa, with stops in Italy, the United States, the UK, Australia, and France.
Her first collection of poetry, The Humane Society, was published by a British press in 2012. Her latest book is due out this month, and it's called My Dark Horses.
Lake Effect's Mayon Silver reached Hollander via Skype from Colorado, and Hollander began by talking about what she thinks makes a good poem.
There are things you can do to help it move along. Space and time and quiet and reading lots of good poetry can help. But really, the poem will mature when the poem is ready to mature, and too much ambition can actually kill the poem. So I think one of the great lessons that I've learned as a poet is that you have to be willing to follow the lead of the poem and let the poem create itself when it's ready.
One of the things that you write about a lot is your family and your childhood. Would you call your family and your childhood as sort of a muse of your poetry?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was very fortunate to grow up in a family of professional classical musicians. And for a poet, I think that you really couldn't ask for a better groundwork to deal with, because as far as I'm concerned, really the music that one hears within a poem is the most important part of making a good poem. And so growing up in that environment where there was constantly classical music being talked about and played really gave me a background and structure to work with. And then, of course, my family itself, their dynamic was interesting for me as well to write about. I mean, I think it's a unique upbringing in that not many people grow up in these kinds of circumstances. So it really gave me some interesting subject matter to work with as well.
Well, and, you know, the idea that everybody in your family was a musician or a classical musician, and you didn't really take to that so much, right?
That's right, yeah.
So you had to kind of find your own way and feel a little bit like, you know, you were charting new territory, sort of.
Absolutely. I felt like the black sheep for most of my childhood because I wasn't a classical musician. And I think that was actually good for me in terms of the building of a poetic sensibility, because I think that sort of by nature, poets are on the outskirts and they're observers and oftentimes are the black sheep. Of course, as a kid, you just want to fit in and you want to be in the mix and you want to be like everyone else in your family. So it had its challenging moments, but ultimately I think that the recipe was actually perfect for creating a poet.
Well, and one of, you know, everyone can kind of relate to family relationships aren't always perfect. They aren't always easy. And you had, you know, sort of some somewhat tense relationship with your mom during the large swath of your life. So this poem that I want to ask you to read, you have a poem prepared, and I was wondering if you would be willing to read it.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Is there any context to the poem that you want to lay out?
Well, the context is really that I was living abroad at the time over in England, and my mother had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, which is a really ugly diagnosis. And I was home for the holidays trying to help. And I was just sort of asking, what can I do to help? And what my mother wanted was a pair of overalls, actually. And the reason was she was hoping to still be able to practice the cello, but to be able to wear something that could protect her surgery scars. So I was tasked with heading out to Farm and Fleet to buy her a pair of overalls. And I couldn't help but feel that there was an incredible irony that this concert classical cellist was going to be wearing a pair of overalls. And so I came up with this poem, Shopping for Overalls in Milwaukee. I'm looking for a pair of overalls for my mother, something to cover up her surgery scars. But these days, she's getting smaller and smaller, and I wonder if anything here will fit. Can I help you? The store clerk asks. No, I snap. She wouldn't understand. The overalls all seem to hang listlessly like oversized dolls, with long legs dragging on the floor and wide asses sagging in the back. So I wander to the children's aisle and slip on a pair. In the mirror, I see my mother looking straight back at me, her sharp nose, her hurting eyes. And I wonder if it's too late to trade my happiness for hers. I buy the overalls anyway and wrap them in a silly bag, wanting to make her smile after chemo. I'll place the overalls near her pillow and hope when she awakens, I can try rolling up the long pants legs, adjusting the long straps on her shoulders, cinching the brass buttons on her waist. Then I'll lift up her bald white body and somehow try and keep her inside.
It's interesting. You could write pages and pages of prose about seeing your mother die of cancer, and maybe these pages of prose would not be as powerful as 26 lines of poetry. What is it about the structure and the form of poetry that fits with you?
Well, I like to think of poetry as somewhere in the middle between prose and music. And so, in my opinion, all good poetry has a really strong musical quality to it. And so for me, if I can make words sing in some capacity, then I'm giving them a different sort of meaning than what the meaning would be if I were to write a story or an article or a prose piece. You can hear a pattern of stresses and non-stresses, which serve to create a music within the line of poetry. there's really something about music that is ear-pleasing, that's attractive, that we love. People love music. So if I can make my words musical, in my mind, I'm creating the most heightened, most emotional experience for the reader to have.
Well, you have a poem that does that really well called Metronome from your first book. It has the musicality that you're talking about, and it draws you into an emotional experience. Can you read that one?
Sure. The Metronome. She set the metronome ticking, her children the pendulum, rocking back and forth from mother to father, father back to mother. Then she'd twist the knob to father, mother, mother, father, or call out allegro and they'd speed up, father, mother, mother, father, father, mother. Her children walked sideways, their eyes shifted horizontally. They looked dizzy, even possessed, missing the cars zooming in front of them. But somehow they always heard mother's tempo and passed from this lover to that lover, from that lover to this.
That poem, you not only have the musicality of the syllables and how the words are put together, but there's also music based on the words choices.
Yeah, that's right. I think because, you know, a lot of my childhood was centered around the vocabulary associated with classical music that inevitably would find its way into my poems. And a lot of my poems in the Humane Society and also in My Dark Horses are about being a classical musician. And in some ways, maybe indirectly, are reflective also of what it's like to be a poet.
Well, Jody Hollander, I really appreciate you coming and speaking and reading some of your poems, and I hope that you have a lot more muses to come.
Thank you so much for having me.
Poet Jody Hollander is a Milwaukee native. Her newest collection of poems called My Dark Horses is set to come out this month. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mayan Silver via Skype from Colorado back in January. And that's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and keep listening because Fresh Air is next.